Last case is Greater Philadelphia versus City of Philadelphia Chamber of Commerce versus City of Philadelphia. Ready to proceed?
Thank you, Judge McKee, and may it please the court. My name is Marcel Pratt, and I am the city solicitor of the City of Philadelphia, and I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Pratt, you've been in the cheap seats all week long. You've been sitting back there spying on us?
Just a little bit.
Did you finally get up into the front row, the suite?
I learned a thing or two.
Okay, so. Let's go. We'll find out. Hey, you finally, you finally make it up into the balcony, into the orchestra seating.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
So today, first I'll discuss the district court's flawed ruling that the inquiry provision of the wage equity ordinance does not satisfy intermediate scrutiny. And then I'll discuss the correct part of the district court's ruling that the reliance provision regulates conduct and not speech.
Let's start with whether or not the district court got it right in applying intermediate scrutiny, because I think your friends over there are going to say that it's strict scrutiny and not commercial speech.
Oh, yeah, we can deal with that pretty easily. So for 4 decades now, the Supreme Court has applied intermediate scrutiny to content-based, speaker-based commercial speech. And we have to take the Supreme Court at its word. If it wanted to change the law, it would have done so, and it would have done so explicitly. And what we've seen is that over the course of time, that has not changed. If you think about RAV, which the chamber relies upon heavily, RAV was decided in 1992. Since then, Central Hudson and RAV have coexisted for 27 years at this point. Sorrell and Reed as well, they didn't change the law either. This court, as well as
talk about heightened scrutiny.
Well, heightened scrutiny is a reference to a level of scrutiny other than rational basis. And that's a point that this court has made, in the sense of this court has referred to heightened scrutiny in other cases, and it simply meant something above rational basis. And the Ninth Circuit en banc makes this point beautifully in the RDN versus Prieto case, where it talks about the meaning of heightened scrutiny. And it talks about a part of Sorrell where they say, well, Sorrell mentioned heightened scrutiny, but it cites the cases that applied intermediate scrutiny, such as the Discovery Network case. I think that point is pretty easy for us to deal with. No court has done what the chamber is asking this court to do. And every court to confront this exact question of whether or not intermediate scrutiny, or whether or not Reed or Sorrell has somehow changed Central Hudson, has answered in the negative. And specifically, I'm talking about the Eighth and Ninth Circuits, and we cite those cases in our brief. So where I wanted to start was with some foundational concepts that are indisputable, that go to the foundation of this ordinance. It's indisputable that there are racial and gender wage gaps in this country. No one disputes that. The researchers see it in the data. Women and people of color see it in their paychecks. It's not in dispute. It's also indisputable that there's a consensus among labor market researchers that the wage gap is in part caused by discrimination.
Well, when you say the consensus, where on the record did you introduce evidence of that record, of that research?
Professor Madden.
Okay.
Professor Madden.
And she testified, her affidavit was submitted after the ordinance was enacted?
Yes, that's correct.
Does that matter that her her testimony was not available to the city council when the ordinance was being considered?
Absolutely not. We're entitled to come forward with evidence at the time of challenge that supports the inference. And if I may, I just want to read a very dispositive quote from this court's decision in Phillips. There is a significant difference between the requirement that there be a factual basis for a legislative judgment presented in court when a judgment is challenged, and the requirement that such factual basis have been submitted to the legislative body prior to the enactment of the legislative measure. We have always required the former. We have never required the latter. And I think, you know, this court's cases show that to be true, that you can come forward at a later point in time or when the challenge comes to court to justify the inference that the legislature drew.
Are you just saying basically she validates the findings of the municipal body?
Exactly, yes. Good. That's correct. And so, again, that point, this consensus around discrimination being embodied in the wage gap is really indisputable. And experience keeps telling us that this wage gap will not go away on its own. And so when you're confronted...
Does it show that precluding employers from considering wage history will meaningfully impact or address that discrimination?
Well, I think we get there through the evidence that I'm going to talk about today, and also just simple common sense and an empirical basis for it. Because, again, what we know is that when you're a woman or a person of color, and again, we're talking about in the aggregate, if employers are going to use your prior salary history as a basis to pay you, your baseline is going to be lower. And that's precisely because of the wage gap and because your prior salary history is tainted by discrimination. And so it's a logical inference to say, and again, we have more to back this up, but if an employer is going to rely on this lower baseline, which is in part caused by discrimination, that you're going to keep perpetuating the wage gap. And we don't have to prove the point because the Supreme Court has never said we have to come forward with that level of specificity. But I want to, you know, jump back to this common sense point. Because when you're confronted with this problem, I think common sense might lead you to the following epiphany. If the lower salary histories of women and people of color are tainted by discrimination, and employers keep relying on them, then how about we try having employers not ask for prior salary history? That is the logic behind the wage equity ordinance. And that is, quite frankly, the most common sense solution to this problem. But we don't stop with common sense. We have evidence to back it up, and specifically four categories. First, Professor Matten, who is one of the top labor economists in the country.
But she can't really say that this will cure it.
She can't, and no one does. Even during the city council testimony, Councilman Greenlee said that this isn't going to completely solve it, but it'll help. It'll help.
And we don't even know it will help. We assume it will help, but we don't know it will help. What if we find out there are more and more cities and states that are adopting this type of regulation? What if we find out 5 years down the line that it doesn't help? Is that...
Yeah, well, that's what legislatures do, right? They try out measures that are drawn based on the evidence, and they draw logical inference. And if something isn't working, they tweak it. And that's just simple legislative policymaking at work. And I think that's done pretty routinely by legislative bodies.
How about the response and by the chamber that this is useful information for us to learn what a position like this is paid through other employers in the city?
Yeah, they have other sources.
In other words, this is what this job is worth, and that's what, and that'll give us a baseline to decide what we're going to pay this candidate.
There are other sources of that information. That data is available in other places, but I also think that if the...
Where is it available?
There's employers access market wage data all the time, and I think that data is available out there. But I think if the chamber wants to figure out things like how much would it take to afford this particular person, as well as if, you know, they're skilled or experienced or they're educated, because they've said that salary history is a proxy for those things, those are all things you can simply ask. I mean, this ordinance is very narrow. It prohibits one question and one question only. You can still ask people, how much would it take for you to come here and work for us? This job pays $30,000. Is that enough for you? If it's not, then tell us why.
What you can ask is what you were earning at your last position.
Is that right? And that is the only question that is off limits.
Interesting. I just didn't do this before, but just while you were speaking, I just typed in the query, average salary legal secretary of Philadelphia. I got back ranges from $45,000 to $59,000 with an average base salary of $51,276. It took me about 5 seconds, maybe 3 seconds to do that, because my one finger is sore. It took me longer than it normally would.
Yeah, I think it's pretty easy to do. You can figure out a lot of things online and through other types of research. But in terms of the district court's mistakes that it made, first I want to start with how high it set the bar, because the district court essentially said that we have to prove scientifically that this ordinance would, as a matter of fact, close the wage gap. The problem with that is the Supreme Court has never said that. The Supreme Court has never said that under intermediate scrutiny, you must prove that your piece of legislation will work.
Has it said it under strict scrutiny? That was my lobbying you.
So yeah, well, the strict scrutiny doesn't apply, but I think, you know, we've...
I'm not the only one who throws off last
year. Yeah.
I'm thinking of Burson. It's a strict scrutiny
I think with
case.
Strict scrutiny, you have to get pretty close. I think the...
Well, in Burson, it was a strict scrutiny case dealing with bubble zones around polling places, and the court said that the legislature could rely upon common sense.
Well, that, yes.
Bubble zone.
Right, that is correct. And in Florida Bar, the Supreme Court did say that history, consensus, and common sense can even get you past strict scrutiny.
But so, they also had a 106-page study. I'm not sure how good it was, and the Senate takes issue with it in Florida bar to back up legislators' finding.
Yeah, and I don't think we necessarily need to focus on page counting here, because if you look at the evidence of what that 106-page study was, it was a collection of anecdotal evidence, some surveys from people. So Florida bar was a case about, it was a law that prohibited attorneys from sending mailing solicitations to people who had suffered an injury in an accident within 30 days. And the idea was to sort of protect people's privacy as well as to protect the reputation of lawyers in Florida. And what the Supreme Court had before it was, in this 106-page summary, was some anecdotal evidence, some surveys from people saying, you know, we don't like to receive mailing solicitations, and also some data about the number of mailings that go up. It didn't have any sort of empirical demonstration that, you know, if you decrease, you know, attorney solicitations within a certain time period, that it was going to somehow have an effect, a measurable effect on the reputation of attorneys or how harassed people feel. And even before the Supreme Court got to the 106-page summary, it reminded us that you can satisfy intermediate scrutiny in the commercial speech context just based on history, consensus, and simple common sense. And so even that case didn't draw that exact connection. But, you know, in terms of what the district court here, so not only did the Supreme Court never say you have to make this type of a scientific demonstration, but what the district court required here was impossible. It was impossible for us to meet because no one else has done it before. You know, the suggestion is that we somehow perform some controlled study where you look at one jurisdiction who hasn't done it and one jurisdiction who has. I mean, that could take years. But the simple point here is that that's not required under intermediate scrutiny.
Is any other jurisdiction doing this, at least one that you know of?
Are they other jurisdiction?
Have such an ordinance.
Oh, yes. Yes. And I believe the Massachusetts brief provides a link to all the jurisdictions that are doing this. But California, for example, they've had their law in effect for over a year now, and it does the same thing that our law does. New York City, theirs went into effect in October of 2017. Delaware has this type of law. Connecticut, Oregon, I don't know if I already said Massachusetts, San Francisco, Vermont. The list has grown. The list has grown. And
To the extent the list has grown, does that increase the amount or the quantum of evidence you need to come forward with to sustain your burden?
It certainly helps. I think it helps for us to be able to say other jurisdictions, other states and cities that are confronted with the same problem that we have, they've drawn the same inferences as we have.
But in this case, do we have to look at the situation, as it existed at the time that this action was filed?
Well, I think we can still come forward with evidence, as we talked about earlier, at the time of the challenge. But at the time that this was being considered before City Council knew Massachusetts was doing this because Massachusetts passed their law before the city did. I mean, ours was slated to go into effect first, but they passed their law before we did. We also knew at the time that New York City was considering the same measure, and that's discussed on the record before City Council.
You mentioned Dr. Madden, is it?
Yes.
A number of times. He was apparently a very important witness before the city council.
Dr. Madden did not testify before City Council.
She did? Oh, no. She submitted a report.
Yes. So there was no evidentiary hearing in this case, but we did submit Professor Madden's affidavit to our briefing during the preliminary injunction.
Doesn't that hurt you, the absence of any legislative hearing? Why? And your colleagues over there might just think, well, look, it's irrational. It's irrational to show that. They didn't even attempt to have any hearings to establish a record that would support that, one, that this would be, the discrimination exists. I think they conceded that. Or more importantly, that this measure would deal with that discrimination.
Oh, no, we had a very robust legislative hearing. What we didn't have was an evidentiary hearing.
Okay.
An evidentiary hearing before the district court.
Okay.
So again, the case was, you know, case was in the district court for a year.
In the evidentiary hearing, you took into account reports of expert reports. Is that the way it worked?
At the evidentiary hearing?
Yes.
So we didn't have one. There was no, the district court did not have an evidentiary hearing.
I assume you're talking about legislative hearing.
Yes. Before City Council, there was a bunch of evidence available to city council. So we had the head of our anti-discrimination agency in Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Commissioner of Human Relations. She testified about it. We had a number of policy experts testify as well, or the so-called policy experts, as the chamber calls them at page 46 of their step two brief. But I think the Women's Law Project and the American Association of University Women might know a thing or two about wage equity and policy. But they
who
just
is Victoria Budson. What is her position and what are her qualifications?
Victoria Budson, so she provided some analysis in an article that we attached to our preliminary injunction papers, but she is a professor, I believe, at Harvard.
Okay, she did not come in before city council. That was like Madden. That was something that was
right. To the, yes, she did not test it. But at city council, again, we had the Women's Law Project, which supported this ordinance, and they didn't just provide unsupported opinion. They relied on, for example, the EEOC manual, which talks about the dangers of relying on prior salary history. They also cited to a settlement that Boeing had in an equal pay case. Boeing was sold under the, they were sued under the Equal Pay Act, and because they were using prior salary history to set new salaries. And how did they settle the case? They said, we're going to stop relying on prior salary history. And so the Women's Law Project talked about that case.
The district court, you're talking about prior salaries, but the district court determined that Dr. Madden presented little support for her supposition. The salary differences are not explained by legitimate factors, such as credentials or qualifications. So what is your take on that?
The district court got that completely wrong. So if you read Professor Madden's affidavit, she says that discrimination plays a substantial part in the wage gap that we have. And the district court is talking about the Blau and Kahn study that Professor Madden relied on. And that study talks about how when you control for factors like education, experience, in an area of region, that you still have a wage gap. And so they say the unobserved portion is about 38%. But the district court got it so wrong that the authors of the study, who have been studying this for a very long time, they filed comments to the amicus brief that was filed by the Women's Law Project and 36 other organizations in this case. And they say the district court got it wrong. You know, that part of the district court's opinion that says legitimate factors could be explaining the wage gap, Blau and Kahn say, no, that's not what our study stands for. We very much think, after controlling for all of these factors, that discrimination plays a part in the wage gap.
Where did they say that? Submission to the district court?
They filed this after the district court's opinion came out. It's a comment to the Women's Law Project amicus brief at Appendix B that's filed in this court.
What about the remedy saying, excuse me, that granted that there is a disparity, that the remedy that has been adopted is too broad, that your opponents, the chamber says, you ought to require employers in Philadelphia to do rigid self-evaluation, for instance. Is the remedy you select too broad under this issue of commercial speech and what the remedy should be?
No, because this is the most direct way of addressing this problem. I mean, we're trying to achieve wage equity, and we know that because of discrimination, the baseline for women and people of color is much lower. And so I know the chamber has talked about encouraging self-evaluations, but again, this hasn't gone away on its own, this wage gap problem. So the idea of encouraging a self-evaluation and not legislating through this solution that we know to be directly targeted to this problem doesn't make sense. And I know the idea of a self-evaluation has been thrown out in other contexts as a supplement to what we're doing here, but not as an alternative.
Okay, but you say directly targeted, and yet no witness can come forward and say, yes, this will work. We have history. We have studies that talk about this unexplained gap, after you consider experience, after you consider education, after you consider the personal capabilities, that there is a gap. We can't explain why the difference still exists. But no one so far has been able to come forward and say, and the chamber comments on this frequently, that your remedy is going to solve that gap.
It's going to help solve the gap. That's the position. But again, because
but can this anyone is in- say it is going to help? I mean, we think about it. We speculate about it. We can't think of any other way to attack it. But is that sufficient?
That it is sufficient. And again, going back to what the Supreme Court said in cases like Alameda Books, when you're trying out a new solution, you're not going to have data on its efficacy precisely because it's a new solution. And also with intermediate scrutiny, I mean, you're striking a balance here. On the one hand, you want courts to engage in an independent examination to ensure compliance with the Constitution, but it also reflects the deference and the leeway that you're supposed to give to the legislative body. I mean, Turner and other cases that the Supreme Court has dealt with talks about this idea of allowing legislatures to make predictive judgments. That's called policymaking. And especially when it comes to innovative solutions to difficult problems, you're not always going to have the evidence. You're not always going to have the conclusive scientific evidence before you. But the best thing you can do is prove to the court that you have drawn a logical inference based on substantial evidence. That's what we have here.
Yeah, speaking of that, you mentioned the Florida Bar case, but the Florida Bar conducted a two-year study before it made its determinations, and the city has not done anything like that here.
We did not commission a two-year study, and I do think it was a mistake by the district court to focus on, you know, this idea of page counting the legislative record or how long the study took, because the Supreme Court has never said you get more deference if your report is very long or voluminous, or you get more deference because you had hearings that lasted for a certain period of time.
The study, of course, become more supportive of your ultimate decision.
Right, but I think in terms of the evidence that was before City Council and the evidence that we've put before the court now, it is based on years of study. I mean, I think the wage gap, the studies that we have that look at the wage gap, I mean, they go back decades. I mean, this has been studied for a very long time, and you have a consensus over the course of decades that discrimination taints wage history information. And that's a very powerful piece of evidence, and I know we didn't commission studies ourselves to prove that point, but again, there's an academic consensus that's been around for quite some time.
Let me ask you a hypothetical. A young woman comes in to get a job. She's been working as a barista and being paid 75% of what the male baristas are getting, and she comes into a restaurant to get a job in the restaurant, and so the manager of the restaurant says, "Where have you been working?" And she says and explains it, and then he says, "Well, I want to get a quick evaluation of you from your former employer. Give me the name and the telephone number." He goes in the back room, he calls him up, and he says, "Mary Jones is here. How much were you paying her?" There's nothing to stop that, right?
So the ordinance on its face does not prevent an employer from doing that. And some other states go that far, but this ordinance does not. But even if the employer were to do that, the employer can't rely on that information in setting the salary of the new employee, because that's the reliance provision would prohibit that.
How can you tell reliance, though? I mean, how can you tell what's going on in his head after he gets that information from the former employer?
I mean, I think we would have to prove it the same way you prove any other anti-discrimination case where you don't know what's going on in someone's head. But I think that's why the inquiry provision is so important, because the inquiry provision is the enforcement tool, right? So if you prevent employers from getting the information in the first place, then you don't necessarily have to worry about this problem of relying.
But are you really preventing them when the employer can go in the back room and call up right away and say, "What was she making?"
Well, the employer can't rely on the information once they get it.
But you were saying it's important to prevent them getting the information. If they want to, in many cases, they can get it very quickly.
Well, also, I think a lot of employers would not necessarily share that information because, just modifying your hypothetical, if this were two companies who were competitors, right, that's something that the competitor might not want to share with their former employee's new employer. So I don't think it's going to be as easy as that. But again, if they get the information, they can't rely on it. And just as a practical matter, if I were advising an employer, I would just advise an employer, not to do that, because if you can't rely on the information, then why take on that risk? But again, the inquiry provision is the key here, and that's why we fought so hard to keep it.
Is it the case that when you ask for wage information, the employer is thinking this is the floor that I have to work with? In other words, I have to pay at least that in order to hire this employee. What's wrong with that?
Well, the problem with that is if you're a woman or a person of color, that the baseline for that negotiation is going to be much lower than your white male counterparts.
I was thinking of paying $40,000, but you just told me you were in $45,000. Now I know I got to deal with that $45,000, and I may increase the salary. What's wrong with that scenario?
You might increase it, but you might not increase it to the same level as some of the white men that work at that particular company, because again, the baseline is going to be lower. And I mean,
well, the employee could disclose it.
The employee has the option of disclosing.
But you're 45, 40 things away.
But in the case the employee, that's right. But in the case that the employee does not disclose the salary, what's wrong with asking? Because you're thinking you have to negotiate now to get that employee to say yes.
Yeah. Well, like I said, we're legislating in the aggregate, so. I mean, we know the data, again, for women and people of color is tainted by discrimination. So that baseline is going to be lower. So,
say my example is an extreme, extreme example.
It's better than the snake on top of the box.
I think the objective of a lot of employers, I mean, it's simple economics, is you want to pay someone as least as possible to get them to come work for you.
Yeah.
And I think that's the issue that the Ninth Circuit had recognized in Rizone. We can talk about that, but... that's one of the reasons why Judge Stephen Reinhart, rest in peace, said that, this amounts to the financial exploitation, those were his words, of women. Because, if you have this economic incentive to pay someone as least as possible, and you're using this discrimination-tainted information, you're just going to perpetuate the wage gap.
But maybe it's good for women's employment because more of them will be hired because you figure you can pay them less.
I don't think the logic behind that quite works, and I don't think that the city would necessarily want that to happen.
Yeah, they're taking notes over there.
Yeah. Google just had to raise the salary of a lot of its men employees.
Well, also, Google, if you look at the New York City amicus brief, or maybe the Massachusetts amicus brief, they've also embraced this type of law because... in response to it, they said, a number of other companies have said this, but, we think these laws are a good idea. We're not going to ask anywhere. Even though we're not prohibited in this place, we're not going to ask anywhere. And the New York amicus brief, points to, I believe, another Fortune 100 company that says, relying on prior wage history contributed to an internal pay gap. So this is great for us. Another bank that New York City talks about said, it's quite easy why we did this. It's to be fair to our employees. So I think...
None of those briefs were before the legislature. I understand they don't have to be before the legislature, but they weren't before the district court either.
Well, the idea that other states were doing this and other companies were reacting positively to it, that point was made to the district court during oral argument. My red light's been on for quite some time. I'm happy to keep going, but...
No. Thank you, Mr. Grimm. What makes you happy doesn't necessarily make us happy.
And I will address the reliance provision on rebuttal with
you. Okay. Mr. Estrada?
Thank you, Judge McKee. May it please the court. I think we have a fundamental disagreement as to what the starting point is here. Mine is that when government tries to use a speech remedy, the government must affirmatively demonstrate that it is really necessary and use it surgically. If a government here or else...
Depend on the whether it's strict scrutiny or intermediate scrutiny?
No.
You say necessary.
No.
That's strict scrutiny.
No, Your Honor, with all due respect. And to make that point, let me cite to you just two quotations from one of the more recent Central Hudson cases, which obviously governs intermediate scrutiny. This is from Western States, the Thompson case. First, this is a quote from the Supreme Court. If the First Amendment means anything, it means that regulating speech must be a last, not a first, resort, unquote. The second one is we have made clear that if the government could achieve its interest in a manner that does not restrict speech or that restricts less speech, the government must do so. That's intermediate scrutiny. A government here or elsewhere could conclude that the minimum wage should be $25 an hour, and they can experiment to their heart's content to see if they have any business left in the city, here or elsewhere. The government could not
reconcile that with language in Alameda Books and Nixon and Burson, which I asked Mr. Pratt about, the bubble zone case,
mm-hmm.
where the court seemed to accept a much lesser burden of proof than was accepted here.
Well, we can talk about each and every one of these cases. Keep in mind that Alameda Books, at least ostensibly, was talking about the secondary effects on the Renton of putting in a second bookstore. And on
They're looking at the element of proof that the government had to show.
Well, to be sure, but that's not a content-based, that's a zoning restriction, right? If you put in a second bookstore of this type, that's going to lead to squalor and crime and that sort of stuff. And under the Renton case, that's not a restriction of the speech as such. That's a zoning restriction.
Are you saying this is content-based?
Yes, of course.
How is it content-based? They don't care what the speaker... It's speaker-based.
No, it is.
But why is it content-based?
Because it addresses the subject matter of what it can be said. I can ask the applicant, how is life today? What's your age? What do you think of the Mets? But I can't ask him, what did you make in your last job? That's clearly content-based.
But it doesn't depend on the viewpoint of the speaker. Or what?
Well, no, but under the law, under the First Amendment, there is quite a difference between content-based and viewpoint-based.
Okay,
and
I should have said both viewpoint. Are actually right. You agree it's viewpoint-neutral?
Yes, I do agree that it is viewpoint neutral, but of course, excuse me, content-based restrictions are still subject to higher scrutiny, even when they're not viewpoint-based. Now, the point that I was going to make is that when you're talking about a speech remedy to whatever the perceived problem may be, the government must demonstrate that it is, in fact, necessary and that it will, in fact, solve the problem.
Necessary to do what?
To solve the problem in a direct and material way. Now we have.
You're getting that language from?
From Edenfield, Greater New Orleans, any number of Supreme Court cases, including then Judge Alito's decision for this court in Pitt News versus Papert. You know, the city has never come back and explained why it disputes that under the third prong of Central Hudson, they must demonstrate that the restriction will advance the solution of the problem in both a direct and a material
way. But in Pitt News, on its face, that was irrational. I think we said counterintuitive. Justice Alito said counterintuitive, and it was unsupported by the evidence. If you're going to single out one kind of alcohol, focus on that, and leave malt liquor and all the other kinds of alcohol alone, it didn't seem to make any sense on its face.
Again, we can go back to what the record is that the city is actually, you know, relying in on Judge McKee, because I think Mr. Pratt went through it very quickly, and I think the district court was treated a little bit unfairness in how it was, you know, described. I think the district court examined what was in front of the city council, which was general statements of there is a wage gap. There was, I think, testimony by Barbara Price from the American Association of University Women, who stated that there is a wage gap, and in a footnote referred to two studies, which if you go read them, sort of analyze, you know, the wage gap and conclude that there is an unexplained element to it that cannot be explained by choice of major or life, etc. And the hypothesis is that that element is due to the discrimination.
In part.
Now, for purposes
do you
of...
Do agree with Mr. Pratt and the district court that the city has a substantial interest in promoting wage equality?
We agreed in the district court that the city has a substantial interest under Central Hudson in eliminating discriminatory wage disparities to the extent that wage disparities reflect differences in experience, education, etc. We do not agree that that is a Central Hudson interest, because I think my clients have an interest in having access to the information,
No one is arguing that experience, past employment history, particular education and characteristics. Like, you aren't going to hire me to be an NFL football player.
Correct.
Me, on the other hand. The Browns have been beating down my door.
To be sure.
The Cleveland Browns would, but no one else.
All I'm saying is that we have a baseline agreement with respect to the substantiality of the interest that respects the government's interest in curbing discrimination, not in equalizing everybody.
Why doesn't the ordinance that they've adopted promote the city's interest in...
I was getting to that point. I mean, there are two aspects to it, and I think, as we made clear in our briefing, I think, you know, the district court was right in concluding that with respect to the inquiry part of it, it fails from three, because if the problem is discrimination,
you agree with the goal, but you say the method is.
Oh yeah, I mean, nobody is in favor of discrimination, Judge Fuentes. We do think that if your goal is discrimination and getting rid of that, a speech remedy is an indirect way of getting at the problem.
You don't disagree that there is discrimination or pay disparity.
We agree for purposes of this appeal that to the extent that there is about a 3% to 6% gap that is unexplained, we can agree that that may be ascribed to discrimination. The problem for the city is that the studies they cite establish that gap comes up in the very first job when there is no wage history. And therefore, by the hypothesis...
I hope you, that means there's an innate, from their perspective, is...
No, but...
Yeah, there's an innate bias built in. You don't need wage history. You look, is this a woman? Is this a person of color? And automatically, the person's rowing against the...
What that tells you is that the causal mechanisms that lead to the discrimination don't have anything to do with the wage history.
Not for the first job, they totally don't. But if there's some mechanism at work there which causes more employers to say to a person of color or to a woman, you're not going to voice that now.
Again,
but if they get less pay from the start, their position is, to the extent you factor that in subsequent job salaries, you're perpetuating it. That's exactly the point.
Again, Judge McKee, if this were not a speech remedy, you know, the government might be entitled to sort of say, we're entitled to take a shot in the dark on that one. The problem for the government is that, you know, the doctrine does say on the Edenfield and all these cases that they have to show that this will actually solve the problem in a direct and material way.
However, about the initial entry into the job market, there's no past history, but some of the evidence produced in this case includes evidence that a woman who stays a long time in a company tends to have less of a wage differential than a woman who moves from one job to the next job to the next job. And in moving from one job to the next job to the next job, if her past salary is taken into account, having started out at a lower basis, if her salary is taken into account, that is perpetuating that discriminatory effect on her salary. And if in these subsequent moves you can't ask her what her past salary was, that this aspect of what has been holding her down would not be a problem.
It might or might not, Judge Roth. Part of the problem with the hypothesis and what is absent from the record in front of the city council and the district court is that we don't actually know the causal mechanism for the perpetuation of the discrimination.
But we've discussed cases that have considered not only studies and anecdotal evidence, but the fact that this is a problem. We aren't sure what the solution is, but common sense tells us what the solution is. And it seems to me that common sense, when we see how salaries can be affected by past employment history and past salaries, the common sense is a good argument for saying that this would be an effective remedy.
Generally, cases from the Supreme Court like Edenfield and the New Orleans case have actually said that common sense and speculation are not enough under this prong of Central Hudson.
Okay, but we have more than common sense,
but
it's an element we can consider.
It is an element if you can also point to a causal sort of mechanism that lets you...
But also, I want to finish answering that, but can you also point me to the language, the page site in Edinburgh where the court says that, because I'm looking at language
from... I'm sorry, in Edenfield, Your Honor?
Mm-hmm. I'm looking from Alameda Books now. I'm looking at the language from Alameda Books, Turner Broadcasting System,
Burson,
which is
the language in Edenfield,
which is a strict scrutiny case. They all say the legislature can consider common sense.
Oh, no. This is from Greater, New Orleans, where the government's argument was that the publication of the alcohol level was a basis of common sense, because if you publish, the alcohol level on the court's beers, that was going to lead to a strength war, and that was
But the problem there was it didn't make any sense. That was the problem.
It didn't apply to wine. Yeah. It didn't apply to
That was a different problem with the scheme, but in fact, what the court first said was that it could not rely on speculation.
But now, a few seconds ago, you said the court has said that you can't rely upon common sense under a central...
On speculation or just pure common sense.
I want you to give me the cite to that.
No. If I said just that obviously common sense applies where common sense applies, Your Honor. But what I was saying is that when you're trying to restrict speech, you have to prove a causal mechanism that will allow you to conclude that this will actually
work. Why can't you assume the mechanism based upon common sense? That's what I'm trying to get at.
No. I am not arguing that common sense doesn't apply when common sense applies. The point that I'm making
here... Are you agreeing then that common sense will allow a legislative body to assume a causal relationship?
When it makes sense not to conclude...
When it's sensible.
When it's sensible.
Okay.
And when there is a record that allows the legislative body to conclude that.
No. I mean, the reference to common sense is when there is no record... our common sense can help us understand.
If there's a record, why would you need common sense? If there's a record, why would you need common sense?
No, the point that I was going to make is in cases like Burson and in other cases like that, the common sense that the court is speaking at is a judgment of experience. What I was going to say...
But where in Burson is the experience? It was a situation with the bubbles on around...
Polling places.
Pardon me?
Polling places.
Did the court in Burson rely upon similar appeals from bubble zones around polling places?
No,
it
was history.
It makes sense that if you put a bubble zone around polling places, you're going to solve the problem. In a strict scrutiny case.
If I could complete, the point that I was going to make to Judge Roth, which was, we know that this comes up in the first job, and we know as well that the city council did not investigate how this history actually is used in particular employment contexts. And so there is...
I hope you're losing me now. What comes up on the first job?
The
wage discrepancy.
Yeah.
Why is that, do you think? The ethers?
No, I mean, for purposes of this, we assume that if there is a discriminatory wage gap, it may arise... when there is no wage history, which is part of our point, which gives you at least on the surface and on the basis of common sense.
Dr. Madden's testimony is that it starts at the very beginning.
Correct. And if you appeal to common sense, you would then intuitively think that as a solution to the problem, then reliance on the wage history is perhaps not the obvious solution to a problem that arises when there is no wage history, just to turn the point around. Second point is, as time passes, there are other informational components of the wage history that have First Amendment value to employers. If you bar usage of that information, you're invading other First Amendment interests that have to be...
What is the interest?
Those have signals as to experience and, responsibility.
You're going to find out about experience. You're going to ask about experience.
Well, to be sure...
You're going to ask about education.
But if I could address that point... In the speech context, government is usually not entitled to say that I may not ask a question or I may not have access to a paper because I can go read it on cable news. Usually it's for the government to demonstrate that the restriction is actually necessary to achieve the purpose, not for me to demonstrate that I cannot get by without the speech or the information. If I could get to the fourth point, because although, one might have sort of interesting arguments about the third prong, the district court didn't get to the fourth prong. And I think, the fourth prong is actually also very exacting under the court's cases.
Not more extensive than necessary.
Correct. And there is a great level of under-inclusiveness and over-inclusiveness here, right? Because, you know, the ordinance applies even in cases where it could not possibly serve the city's asserted interest.
Well, help me and, there. What are some examples of that?
Well, we pointed to some in our brief, right? If the goal of the regulation, for example, is to close the wage gap to catch up women and minorities to white males who make $1 for the 79 cents, and speech is the remedy, you can't ask. It is inexplicable why you can't ask another question to white male applicants, even though it's a speech, you know, restriction.
That'd be a bad idea, actually.
Well,
you should take that back to city council.
If you think about
Why wouldn't the way I'll go back and give you the ordinance? But you're saying that the ordinance would allow them to ask about wage history of white males?
Yeah, you cannot ask anybody, and even though this is ostensibly
So they can't ask white male salary history?
No.
I misunderstood what you're saying.
And so, you know, in a context in which, as the Supreme Court has said, precision is a touchstone, you know, you ask you may not ask a question, it's a speech remedy, to the people to whom you're trying to catch everybody up.
That makes sense. You're saying that if this was a good fit, I use the term fit under the fourth prong, then
it is a discrimination statute, ostensibly.
What they would do is they say you can ask white males, but you can't ask the subject class. That's what you're arguing?
Correct. If you're protecting somebody from discrimination.
Because then you're going to take somebody who's got a built-in advantage and perpetuate that advantage by asking them what they got, and they're going to give you the answer to the highest salary. That makes no sense.
Well, I don't know, because you know, the city's theory is that you're trying not to perpetuate a gap that exists.
Okay, but you're trying not to perpetuate the top of the gap as well as the bottom of the gap.
Oh, no, because, you know, this is the theory.
You're going to continue to pay the white male more because that white male's always gotten more. You're saying,
No, I am just taking what the city council said at face value. They said they were trying to close the gap. They sort of assume that the free market value and the fair pay is the $1, and that what needs to be closed is the 79 cents to the $1.
Right.
If you're going to choose a speech remedy to close that problem, it seems to me that not that saying that you cannot ask, you know, the person who's not, you know, the problem is overbroad. Now, it may look
so you're
like
saying if they just ask the minority person
the
or the
protected classes
woman,
who are
no equal
who are,
protection
who are,
problem with that,
who are victims of discrimination. Now, again, there are any number of cases, like we point out, lockstep salary.
Okay, so if you ask the $1 earning male, he's earning $1, then why cannot the prospective employer say, all right, well, if a man's making a dollar, I'm going to pay this gal 90 cents.
Well, that would be actual discrimination.
If you don't know if he's making a dollar,
that would be actual discrimination.
And we don't want to have any of that, do we?
Yeah, no.
No.
That would be actually actionable under the actual discrimination laws.
If you can prove it.
That would not be a speech claim. And of course, we have, you know, the other side of the scale, where, you know, the city has an exception if you voluntarily, you know, disclose. Now, the city says this is because we want to have the power in the hands of the applicant. Now, here's what we get to the standard, right? Because it's a speaker-based, you know, restriction. And Sorrell and all these cases tell you that if you are going to make a speaker-based distinction, whether intermediate scrutiny or any kind of scrutiny, that is where the law is the most suspect. If you're going
but
to have...
But Sorrell, at least most of the courts have adjudicated after Sorrell and have cited Sorrell, look at it not as a most scrutiny, heightened scrutiny kind of case, but as an intermediate Central Hudson kind of case.
Well, I think Sorrell, if you read it carefully, first said it was heightened scrutiny.
It did
not say, in fairness, strict scrutiny, but it said heightened scrutiny. But it then said it does not matter because this fails Central Hudson.
Right.
We think that is true here as well, though I think in fairness to what Justice Kennedy said in Sorrell, what he did say I think is equally applicable here, which is that when you have a speaker and content-based restriction, you have to be especially exacting with questions of fit and be especially suspicious when a city or state government says that you're going to put the power in the hands of one speaker and disfavor one speaker only. Here you have a law that basically says there is one category of speakers, you know, employers, not landlords, not bankers, not anybody else who cannot ask this question and cannot rely on the question. If I could take just one moment to deal.
But they aren't the ones who are determining what the wage is going to be of the new employee.
I understand, you know, the nature of the problem, Judge Roth. And I have no issue with the city's desire to address the problem. My issue here is with the choice of remedy, a speech remedy. You know, the city, as we had made very clear, had an obligation to consider other potential solutions to the problem.
So what are those?
Well, sure. One of the studies that the city actually was cited to by Ms. Price, which is one of the American Association of University Women, actually, you know, this is the 2017 version of the study, actually pointed out the internal equity studies, which we also urged upon the city council, have been very successful in solving this problem.
How does that work? That's kind of an internal self-examination?
Yes. And
historically, how would self-examination work out?
Well, according to this study that was presented by the AUW, has been successfully used by some organizations in actually realizing that there were inequities and fixing them. Now, there was an example sort of alluded earlier.
Was it that in some organizations it may well work, in other organizations it may not work?
Well, and again, the obligation of governments under the doctrine is to consider and thoughtfully explain why these issues have been considered and not worked. I will, you know, remind the court, with all respect, that even when potential choices are voluntary with the parties, in Sorrell, you know, the court pointed out that a doctor could put a sign saying no solicitation, and that was an alternative that the government should have considered. And of course, under other levels of scrutiny, I know Judge Roth wrote the opinion in Playboy that ultimately went to the Supreme Court, and there was, you know, the voluntary use of blocking software. You know, these things are usually considered by the courts in examining whether the government has considered whether speech, which is the last, you know, resort, has, you know, really, is actually really needed to solve this problem. So we pointed to these self-evaluations. We also pointed to more aggressive enforcement of anti-discrimination laws. And keep in mind, again, we're not here to dispute the government's ability to tackle problems. We're here to dispute the choice of speech as the first remedy.
This may turn on the outcome of the disparate impact theory, but if you're prosecuting, say, a Title VII claim and failure to hire, and the employer comes in and says, well, I gave her less money because I knew what she'd been making before. I wanted to lure her away from the other job. I gave her an increment over the other job. I'm sorry that it's a certain percentage less than some of my male employees were making, but it's based upon her prior salary history. Now, what you've done then, as they have argued, is you've institutionalized a pay gap, but the employer, under a discrimination theory, he or she's not discriminating. He's based the income not upon the person's gender, but upon their prior salary history.
That is correct generally under federal equal pay law. But again,
But you just said that's one way to deal with the problem.
No, I mean, I said that is greater enforcement of anti-discrimination laws.
Is one way to deal with the problem.
Well, to deal with discrimination that is actual to discrimination. I think the hypothetical that you gave me involved an employer that was not discriminating.
Right, the employer is just following a line and basing upon something that came before, which builds in, institutionalizes discrimination.
No, McKee, but if your hypothesis is going to be that there has been, you know, discrimination at point one, and my hypothesis is that you have to fix that by enforcing anti-discrimination laws, clearly the enforcement can't be at point 20.
What I said is not discrimination. So how do you enforce anti-discrimination laws? No, what I know.
My hypothesis, maybe I was not clear, is that if there is a discrimination that arises at the first job, maybe you should fix it at the first job. And if greater enforcement of discrimination laws is needed, that would be the appropriate point for a government to intervene and make sure that discrimination does not arise then.
We don't have to solve the whole problem at once. When you have a problem, you can pick out a certain part of it. And I think it would be a lot harder to solve the problem, perhaps, at the first job, because it's very difficult to prove there was discrimination. But as the employment history goes along, and if the new salary is going to be based on the old salary, that's a good way to cut out the salary as a source of wage discrimination.
There are two problems with that, Judge Roth. You know, the first one is that, you know, the law generally is clear under your case in Mariani, and I think, you know, the Supreme Court, you know, decision in NIFLA last term, that governments have some leeway in solving problems one step at a time, with the caveat, which was recognized by this court in the Mariani case and by the Supreme Court in NIFLA, is that when they do that, they cannot do it for reasons related to the suppression of speech. Again, there's always, you know, the example, you can't do this if you're going to have content-based exceptions. If the city is going to have a solution that is speech-based, it cannot turn around and say, oh, but we're going to allow the employee to, you know, remain in power of the information and have a gaping exception that deserves, you know, the goal of the ordinance and makes it over-inclusive or under-inclusive. For better or for worse, you know, the doctrine, you know, requires, you know, the government, when it picks speech solutions, to be targeted at solving the problem, solve only the problem, and to have a very good fit. If the government wants to solve the problem through other tools in its arsenal, it has greater leeway.
But what are those other tools? Self-evaluation. Is there anything else?
Well, I mean, you know, the Supreme Court is not very forgiven with speech remedies, and it has even gone so far as to say if the government wants to conduct a public education campaign on its own dime, this is what the court did, you know, last term in NIFLA, you know, the government can enforce laws, it can do any number of other things, but it doesn't, you know, have the right, unless it has a very good record and a very good reason and a very good fit, precision, it said the court.
You're saying very good fit. We're looking now at Supreme Court's language from Board of Trustees of State University versus Fox.
That was
and what the court said, a fit that is not necessarily perfect, but reasonable. It's a reasonable fit that the court has to have.
Judge McKee, because that was 1989. And as we make clear in a brief, you know, Central Hudson has suffered an evolution in the court's work. And this is why I started, when I started my argument, I quoted from the Western States case, which is also a Central Hudson case, and where the court took, you know, the same element of Central Hudson. It said if the government could achieve its interest in a manner that does not restrict speech or that restricts less speech, the government must do so. And so, yes, you know, the government started by saying...
That's reasonable, I understand.
Yeah, but that was 20 years ago, and I think the government over the last two decades, I mean, excuse me, the court over the last two decades has moved to a greater level of exactness.
The single best disposition.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
That's still not saying it has to be single best disposition.
No, but it does say that if the government could do it in some other way that is not speech invasive, the government must do so.
Okay, and that's not even Central Hudson. That's just basic First Amendment law.
Well, that's right. But I think, you know, in the examples that the court has given, including, you know, last term in NIFLA, you know, the court has said, you know, that among the examples that the government may not slight include voluntary conduct, including public, you know, relations campaign by the government itself.
I missed that. Including
public public education campaigns by the government itself. That's, you know, the Becerra case from last term.
But public education has also worked out pretty well in terms of dealing with discrimination.
Again, you know, one may disagree with many things that the Supreme Court does, but that is, you know, the state of the doctrine. And, you know, bottom line is, you know, the Bill of Rights, it's fairly cherished, too. And when the government wants to do speech remedies, you know, the walls are pretty high. If I could just take one moment to deal with the part of our cross appeal, you know, the district court basically took the view that the reliance provision does not involve speech. And, you know, we think fairly quickly that that is clearly incorrect for two reasons. You know, the first one is that, you know, the reliance provision actually does deal with speech on the face of the ordinance. As the district court looked at the ordinance, I think it basically conceived of the ordinance as a kind of thought crime, that, you know, an employer determines what a salary might be by thinking of it and not writing it down on a file or communicating it to somebody. And it's sort of difficult to understand why the city council would pass such an ordinance or how it would enforce it. If you read, you know, the ordinance, you know, its plain terms actually do make clear that what the city council contemplated was a give and take that is actually inherently riven with speech. It says to determine the wages for such an individual at any stage in the employment process, including the negotiation or drafting of any employment contract. So it's inherent in the reliance provision that the determination is the act of picking the wage and negotiating it with the employee. And so the threshold determination of the district court that this was purely conduct and did not involve any speech activity at all.
I think that negotiation involves speech, which I think you're probably right about that. And to the extent that you factor out prior history, then you're impacting the employer's speech.
Correct. I mean, it seems
isn't
to me...
Isn't that the whole point here?
Well, correct. I mean, you might say, in your judgment, you may conclude that this is within the city's power. We disagree. I'm addressing his threshold
okay,
determination
that, not speech, okay.
that this is not speech. Okay. Now, for the same reasons I've been discussing, I think ultimately, I think, you know, the city would not meet Central Hudson or much less any higher level of scrutiny, because ultimately, even if you think that this has some tendency to solve the underlying problem of discrimination as a matter of common sense, it will fail, the type of fit that the Supreme Court actually requires. But I think at the threshold, the district court on the face of the ordinance was clearly incorrect in concluding that this does not implicate speech at all. The second reason that we think that the district court was incorrect is that one is the reason that the court gave in Sorrell, which is that if you preclude someone from using information after you have acquired the information by asking somebody else, that is a burden on the inquiry, that is a burden on the use of information that has been obtained by expressive activity, and that itself is a matter of First Amendment concern. That was, in fact, what was at issue in Sorrell. The city seems to think that it was of great significance and maybe conclusive in Sorrell that the information was going to be used for further expressive activity in Sorrell, to wit, marketing. This is true here too, because it's going to be a give and take with the employee, but B, that is not actually a correct reading of Sorrell, because Justice Kennedy did point out that this would be a question under the First Amendment, and I'm quoting, even if the information were treated as a commodity. And so even with the derivative use of the information, having made the inquiry, as Judge Roth hypothesized earlier, by calling the earlier employer, you could not really say, as a matter of doctrinal First Amendment case law, Sorrell and, you know, the case that it cited, you know, Reinhardt, that if you burden my right to ask a question by not allowing me to use the information, that that's not a First Amendment problem at all. Now, as to the merits of the question, I do think that even if you thought that there was some common sense appeal to the proposition that you can curb the use of the information and not really worry about all the non-discriminatory aspect of the information to which the employer actually also has, you know, the right to use and that have First Amendment value, you're going to get past, you know, the prong three analysis, ultimately, I think it's very difficult for the city to overcome the prong four Central Hudson analysis because of the fit.
We've discussed the prong four.
And that's true as to
what you were saying about reliance.
And that's true as to both of them, especially in a world as we are here, where whatever the city may say is Central Hudson plus, at least after Sorrell and Reed. That point we think is made clear both by this court's decision in King, which made clear that when something is content-based, even if it's otherwise...
That's King versus Governor of New Jersey?
Yes. Even
but
if it's
but there again, we talked about common sense being sufficient.
Well, sure, but you also said that even with respect to lesser protected speech, if it's content-based, you get strict scrutiny, unless an exception actually applies. And now the exception that was held to apply there was professional speech, which the Supreme Court ultimately turned down in NIFLA. But we do.
I get the feeling if I don't step in, we're going to be here till Sunday.
No, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. I understand your argument. Thank you for making it, Mr. Estrada. Mr. Pratt? Briefly, not like a New York minute.
It'll be brief. So I'll start with prong four. There was a discussion around prong four and what exactly is required. Prong four is not a least restrictive means test. The Supreme Court has never changed that. And I know
it's a fit. It's a reasonable fit.
It's a reasonable fit. We're there. I also want to address this idea that the ordinance could somehow allow asking the salary history question of white males. I think the questioning here today revealed why that's problematic.
That would be addressed so quickly that, I mean, you talk about a textbook equal protection issue. That's it.
Right. So in addition to the constitutional issues that create, I think it's very hard to apply practically. I mean, this is America. Racial identity is very complex. You can't have an HR person or just anybody for that matter sitting across from someone trying to figure out if they're a white male or not. Also on that point, I want to talk a little bit about your decision, Judge McKee, and Hefner. You got that wrong?
Well, I'm asking, what did I get wrong?
Oh, I think you got it right. Oh, I think it's a beautiful example for us.
Oh, okay.
Example for us because that dealt with the funeral director's law in Pennsylvania, and there were two commercial speech restrictions at play. One passed intermediate scrutiny, and one didn't. The one that didn't was a prohibition against funeral homes using trade names. And the idea was to protect people from being misled by trade names. You said, look, there's not even an allegation here that people are being misled by trade names. And this also suffers from the Edenfield problem of no evidence because there was no allegation. And also it suffers from the irrationality problem of cases like Rubin and Pitt News. And so you said it made no sense, so it doesn't pass intermediate scrutiny. On the other hand, there was another commercial speech restriction in the form of a prohibition against funeral home sales employees from selling pre-need funeral arrangements to people who come in and want those types of arrangements. And the idea was that those people are very vulnerable, right? So if you prohibit being paid off of commissions, then you'll disincentivize people from taking advantage of those vulnerable consumers. And there you reason just based on common sense. You didn't require an empirical demonstration.
Colleagues often think they don't have any of that.
I mean, there you didn't require you didn't require some empirical demonstration that if you eliminate or decrease commissions, that less people are going to be taken advantage of by funeral homes. No, you just simply used your common sense. And on the fit point, you were actually cited by King. For the exact proposition that we've already talked about, which is the fit doesn't have to be perfect here. I also want to talk about the first jobs point that Mr. Estrada brought up. So there's no evidence that the entire wage gap arises at first job. But I agree with you, and there was a concession that there is some discriminatory activity at the first job. It doesn't matter because at some point that first job salary history, it becomes prior salary and gets relied upon in a subsequent job. And the chamber also mentioned that that the percentage of the wage gap that's due to discrimination is about 3 to 8%. That's not accurate. That's based off a study that was using a data set from the 1980s that was projecting where the gap would be in the 90s, and we discussed that in our brief. But as far as these percentages go, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if 3% or it's 30%. If we've eliminated wage history from being relied upon because of the discriminatory taint, we've promoted our goal of wage equity. And it's not good enough to simply say, you know, well, this gap is only 3 to 8% according to some social science that was done in some legal briefs. And we say to women and people of color, you know, it'll dissipate over time. You know, just work harder, you know, work your way up, and this gap will go away at some point. And there are some studies that support that. We don't have that option of doing that. And that's not what this law wants to do. I want to switch to reliance because we do think the district court got that correct because the reliance provision regulates conduct, not speech. The act of relying on a piece of information is conduct. Just to use an example, if you look at
Mr. Sada's point that when that reliance translates into contract negotiation, that give and take, that becomes speech and you're burdening speech at that point.
No, because you don't. Speech doesn't trigger liability under the reliance provision, right? The moment you rely on salary history, you violated the ordinance. And an example is this. It's illegal to rely on somebody's race or gender in deciding how much to pay them, right? That doesn't turn those types of anti-discrimination laws into speech restrictions. It's a prohibition against relying, and that's what this ordinance does here. And even if there was some incidental impact on speech, that doesn't require First Amendment scrutiny either. The Supreme Court makes this example over and over again, and it makes it in the Expressions Hair Designs case that the chamber cites, as well as Sorrell. And the example is that if you have an anti-discrimination law that prevents or prohibits discrimination in employment, just because it would require an employer to take down a sign that says white applicants only doesn't turn that regulation into a speech restriction. It doesn't. The impact is incidental. We don't think there's an incidental impact here at all. But even if that were the case, you still wouldn't have to engage in First Amendment scrutiny on the reliance provision. And as far as Sorrell goes, Sorrell is distinguishable because that was a speech restriction on its face. On its face. It wanted to prohibit the use of
information. You're going to let us know when you stop being brief. Does that mean you stop being brief?
There was a speech restriction on its face. It doesn't apply here. There was also some viewpoint discrimination going on there. And if the court doesn't have any more questions, I'll just...
You're just in.
I'll leave off where I should have opened, which is I want to introduce and acknowledge my colleagues, Jane Isfan and Benjamin Field, who are responsible for the legal briefs and the arguments you heard today.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Madam President. Can we get a transcript of this case? I meant to get one of the last cases. Did you contact counsel in that case, Ms. Hayes and Mr. Gleason, and arrange to get a transcript? Okay.